The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly Extra.
Today in Football Weekly, Leicester-Chelsea. Massive defeat for Mourinho as Nigel Pearson's double act with Ostrich wins all the post-game headlines. And this in the week that Keith Harris died. Elsewhere, with the title race looking dead and buried, we check out the rest of the weekend's action, dabble with scenarios in which Man United could still blow the top four and Newcastle could get stuck into the relegation scrap. There's Championship, Cherries making merry, and why there's actually a much more interesting story in Italy as Carpe the Diem. All this plus a major European football roundup with Milan locked up and Pep like Meghan Trainor no treble after Bayern's spot kick blowout with Dortmund. All of that in today's maxed out Football Weekly Extra. Hey, many thanks to Max Rushton, but I'm not sure frankly about the state that he's left football in. I'm back to find a world a bit like Charlton Heston at the end of that film with the monkeys, find a world in which Leicester are out the bottom three, Bournemouth are in the top flight, Liverpool are out the Steven Gerrard commemorative goodbye cup.
And ostriches can put their heads in the sand.
Ostriches can't put their heads in the sand. Crikey.
They just choose not to.
Right. Barry, you're the son of a vet. Barry Glendening, everybody. Yes. I'm not going to disagree with you. It's almost
well,
as if you
first
come to
I
the
want
pod-
to take exception yeah. or issue yeah. with right. your... I'm not sure why you brought Keith Harris in, because Orville's a duck.
Well, he died this week.
Yeah, when...
So I just think it's nice to, you know, pay tribute.
But it's a common myth that ostriches put their heads in the sand. They occasionally lower their heads to burrow in the ground so they can eat the gravel they need to help digest their food.
Right. I've met an ostrich.
Good for you.
Yeah. And he had a bucket of granite, so there you go. Any other misconceptions or interesting facts that you might have from your veterinary past about ostriches, Barry?
No.
Okay. James Horncastle's with us as well.
Hey, Jimbo.
Looking forward to chatting about Italy and so much more.
Sorry.
With you.
Actually, they don't need to drink. Ever.
Well, no one needs to drink, Barry.
Well, no, but if you don't drink, you will die. Ostriches can live to the ripe old age of 40, I believe, without ever drinking.
Well, how do they absorb liquids? How do they hydrate?
They generate their own liquids in their stomachs,
but
which are full
what,
of
Barry?
Pebbles. I don't know. I'm not that well up on ostrich
I suggest
husbandry.
You're not. Anyway, James Horncastle is here with us. Looking forward to that Italian chat we're going to have later, James. And also Jacob Steinberg.
Hello.
Bang. Lex Alexatar says this is the most boring end to an EPL season ever. That's the Premier League. Top four race and title race over by the start of April. Is it hardly worth me showing up, Jacob?
Yeah.
Because Chelsea, they've won it now with that win at Leicester.
More or less.
Yep.
But okay. It was like this 2 years ago as well. The final day was only Arsenal and Spurs going for the top four.
Oh, yeah. We haven't even got that this time.
Yeah, I know.
There's a little bit of business down the bottom.
Well, yeah, at least that's still going.
But
two years. Well, I feel that if Sunderland don't beat Southampton on Saturday even, mm-hmm. and Leicester beat Newcastle, then suddenly I think it could be heading that way. Yeah.
Right, okay. And Newcastle, the team that's just lost seven games in a row.
Yes.
Remind me what happened last time Southampton and Sunderland faced each other?
Southampton won 8-0.
8-0, okay. That's interesting. Anyway, Chelsea, who are in no ways boring, as I believe has been resolved while I've been away, have won the title. There was a slight scare in this game. Leicester took the lead before half time. Did you want to talk about that or just bang straight into Nigel Pearson's extraordinary post-game performance? It's the Nigel Pearson, isn't it, really?
Well, I was quite impressed with Leicester's performance,
okay.
But yeah, Chelsea were too good for them in the end and sort of one in the eye for everyone who claimed they're boring because they were quite attacking in that game, scored 3 goals.
Good.
Cambiasso played really rather well in that first half. Played an incredible pass from, I think, Ochoa. I agree with Barry. I thought they were kind of, I wouldn't say necessarily worth their lead, but they were certainly, again, really bold and positive in their approach every time they sort of lost, every time Chelsea sort of lost the ball. Yeah, they broke with intent. And yeah, you didn't think it was improbable for them to actually to maybe pull off a result.
Well, especially after the four consecutive wins coming into this game. Now, when I went away, they'd always been just slightly off actually getting the results that perhaps their performances might, some felt, deserved. Have they just found that extra 5%, or does the rest of the league just get kind of 5-10% worse?
I think that winning that game against West Ham at the start of April was a spark for them. They won it very late on, and it was a game that could have gone either way. It was one of those games where that Leicester had where they went 1-0 up in, and then they missed a penalty, and West Ham equalised and dominated for quite a long period in the first half, and they had chances to win it. And Leicester also missed quite a few chances, and then they got a fairly scrappy goal at the end, and it just, I think it put in a much more belief. If they'd lost that game, that kind of game again at home to a side who didn't really, who weren't really that good, then it would have been, I think, a massive blow for them. But right. Then they were able to build on that and go into the West Brom game, get a last minute winner, and suddenly everything's on the up and you're not too far off, because their performances have never been that far off, which is why I think people, the question came to Nigel Pearson last night, what criticism are you talking about? Because I don't think there really has been much criticism of Leicester. I think people have been quite complimentary towards.
So for anyone who hasn't seen this, he's there, he's doing his press conference, and he's talking about how positive his players have remained despite the enormous criticism that they faced.
Yes, and then a journalist says, sorry, what criticism are you talking about?
Right.
At which point we delve into ostrich-based
metaphors. Yeah, Nigel says, if you don't know the answer to that question, then I think you are an ostrich.
Yep.
What's the name of the journalist?
Ian Baker from Wardles.
All right. Your head must be in the sand. Confused Nigel Pearson continues. Nigel. Is your head in the sand? Demands Nigel Pearson. Are you flexible enough? My suspicion would be no. I can, you can't. And by this point, I'm really, what's happening now?
I'm interested by Pearson's sort of level of flexibility, because he's quite a tall man.
Right.
So, I mean, if he could actually show that he can get his head on the floor into the sand, what does he do?
He can fit it up his arse. So.
Right. A point that we'd make to his face if he cares to join us in the pod.
Well, it's a weird one. I mean, it's not the first time he's been rude to a journalist this season, or indeed an opposition player or a supporter. And while he's entitled to be rude if he wants to be, he did say in an interview with Stuart James recently, and I think a few other journalists sat in on that, he said that there's a bit of mischief in there. Whether people think there is or not, I'm not really bothered, to be honest with you. And then he went on to say, you've got to look at yourself in the mirror. I don't like all the aspects of what I do and am or things I've done, but you've got to live with it. And I suppose we could all say that about ourselves.
Mm.
But it just seemed unnecessarily rude. But reading the comments section under the article, which was devoted to this outburst last night, I'd say it was about a 50-50 split between readers who thought the journalist completely deserved what he got.
Really?
For asking a perfectly reasonable question. Pearson made an assertion, the journalist, which was a bit weird, the journalist asked him to back it with evidence, and he couldn't do so went off on this strange, insulting diatribe about ostriches.
Mm.
And I suppose that probably, you know, the fact that so many people thought it was a perfectly reasonable thing for him to do might tell you a lot about what kind of people comment under articles on the internet.
I'm surprised, because I hadn't seen anyone comment positively about it. My favourite comment was from one that you retweeted, actually. This is from Dan Layden, who says, Nigel Pearson, Phil Brown, True Detective Season 3. Boom. Yeah. Well, anyway, there you go. He's clearly got issues. We saw it when the opposition player.
It's the behaviour of a bully, really. Mm. So, yep. But he seems an okay guy generally.
Does he?
Well, he came across very well in that interview with Stuart James. He's a good manager, but
you read that. Imagine now him saying those words very slowly with a fixed grin of a man who's got a shovel in the boot.
Yeah. Well, it's also like swivelling in his chair, really kind of disturbingly.
I was at Burnley on Saturday, and he was asked by a foreign reporter, I'm not sure where he was from, but possibly somewhere in Scandinavia, and the guy said, do you have any advice for Burnley, given that you were down at the bottom a few weeks ago? And Pearson took exception to this and at the end of a minute long lecture about why he wasn't going to answer this question. He finished off by saying, "And that is an awful question." And you just sometimes you just think you could just completely ignore the question. And
right.
I think that journalists can be sometimes that you can be fascinated with your own industry sometimes and think that you are the story, but I think that you can be thick-skinned about this at times and not take it too personally, but it's just very weird, aggressive behaviour from someone who doesn't necessarily need to do it.
Well,
the journalist actually was quite class and dignified about it. He just went, "Thanks, Nige, see you tomorrow," and that was it.
There's another press conference.
Anyway, so they've got Newcastle at the weekend, and he's a former Newcastle manager. He had one game in charge, he lost it 6-0.
Yeah, and they've already beaten them at the King Power Stadium this season in the FA Cup.
Oh, yeah.
Back in January.
All right.
Yeah. So you would massively fancy Leicester for this game.
Right.
They've been playing fairly well all season. You can't fault him for the football.
Indeed.
Which is the most
not.
Important thing.
All right. Anyway, so they're 1 point above the drop, and it's hard to see who's going to roar out of those relegation places and drop them potentially back into it. You mentioned Sunderland and their game against Southampton, which doesn't have particularly auspicious precedents. Who else you got? You got QPR, who are taking on Liverpool at Anfield, where they haven't won since 1990. Liverpool, though, has this suddenly become a very winnable game, given what appears to be happening to Brendan Rodgers' side?
I wouldn't say it's very winnable for QPR, just because their form away from home is so dreadful. But Liverpool, it's as good a time as any in the season to get them, because they're not playing well at the moment. Brendan Rodgers seems to be under a lot of pressure. I never thought he was the genius some people made him out to be, you know, a couple of years ago. And I don't think he's terrible now. And interestingly, a lot of the people who were saying he was a genius a couple of years ago are now saying he's terrible. They're the same people. But QPR will fancy their chances of winning this game. And Liverpool's players do seem to have given up the ghost a bit. I don't know whether Rodgers has lost the dressing room or not. Reports suggest that he may well have. But QPR will fancy their chances. I still don't think they'll win, though. I just don't think they're good enough.
Right. One win in five for Liverpool. No goals in the last two games. And, of course, a defeat at the Casey Stadium. You must have been very excited about that, James Horncastle. On Tuesday, this was Hull, a game that wasn't televised.
No.
No.
But, back-to-back wins, I think.
For Hull?
Yeah.
Mm.
Again, they seem to they really do have a difficult run in. So, to get the points against a Liverpool team that are slumping is certainly a positive. But who have they got next at the KC? Arsenal and Manchester United. Mm. So
they do have a game against Burnley to play. So you would think that on 34 points, that if they could win that and get 37, that would be safe enough. I think that winning these last two games was probably quite unexpected. Against Palace and Liverpool.
Excellent. Well, they're all right then, are they? And that game against Arsenal is coming up on Monday. Burnley, meantime, who are now very much bottom of the pile and 5 points from safety, will be visiting West Ham, Jacob.
Yep. Yeah. Well, Burnley have 3 away games out of the last 4. You would look at their fixtures and say they're all actually quite winnable. They're against sides who are from Stoke down, basically, and they play Hull, they play Aston Villa, so sides around them, and but they've stopped scoring. They have scored 3 goals in their last 10 games. Curiously, those goals have come against Chelsea, Manchester City, and Manchester United, which is a weird little statistic to go with that. But against Leicester on the weekend, they played quite well, and then got the penalty, missed it. Danny Ings has stopped scoring. They missed Ashley Barnes, Lukas Jukovic and Marvin Sordell are just the championship strikers. They're not quite good enough for this level. And you'd have to think that they're going.
Right. It's just going to be a really confusing fixture for David Cameron, of course.
Yeah, it is.
It's such a delicate time as well for the poor chap. He'll really be feeling this one. Anyway, I did mention before about Newcastle. So what we're effectively saying is that those teams there are maybe Leicester. Would you care to construct some kind of scenario in which Newcastle actually ended up going down, would they be able, for example, to win, to lose all their remaining fixtures and still stay up?
Possibly. They've got Leicester away, West Brom at home, QPR away and West Ham at home. So if you can't get one win out of that four, then you kind of deserve to go down. Ultimately,
but would
though,
they go down?
Would they go down? You could see possibly Sunderland not getting another win, given that they're... Well, they play Southampton on the weekend. That's difficult. Then they've got Everton away next week. Everton have picked up form. The big game for them is that they play Leicester at home in 2 weeks' time. But their last two games are Arsenal and Chelsea away.
When they played Leicester earlier in the season, that was the beginning of what, a six-game winning streak that they had in all competitions for Newcastle under Pardew. So they came out of that sort of slump and were surprising everyone. So
what would be really interesting is if it did come down to the final day for Newcastle, when they'll be facing West Ham managed by
Sam Allardyce.
Yes.
And, you know, you could just see a Kevin Nolan scrappy 3 yard out winner, and then maybe West Ham could leave the pair of them up there.
Wow.
Yeah. Doesn't bode well, because I mean, with Carver, I think he's got what, 9 points out of a possible 45. Their record since taking over is 20th, the bottom of the Premier League since he's been in charge. So doesn't bode too well.
Anyway, that's it. That's enough of a relegation scrap chat, and that's pretty much all we need to say. There are one or two other Premier League games. Maybe we'll whiz through those after this bit of music.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
Yep, those other games in full include Chelsea, who are hosting Crystal Palace at the weekend. Oscar's in doubt after getting clattered by Ospina. Not sure what the latest is on that.
Well, he got a concussion, didn't he? So you'd imagine he should at least be stood down for at least 2 weeks. And if they don't need him, which they don't, then just give him the rest of the season off.
He was on the bench at the King Power Stadium on Wednesday night. Controversially, if he indeed had a concussion. Chelsea did retain the FA Youth Cup with a 5-2 aggregate win over Manchester City.
Yeah, they've got some really good youngsters at Chelsea, particularly Ruben Loftus-Cheek.
He'll be appearing in a European league near you soon, probably.
Yeah, well, Mourinho was saying a couple of months ago that he would be involved much more next season, that he'll try to get involved in the pre-season training and the pre-season friendlies that they do. They've got a couple probably coming up, I think, at the end of the season. The rest that they need is to go off on some jaunt to America or wherever it is they're going to go. And he's a very promising midfielder. And then there are people like Isaiah Brown as well. And obviously Solanke, who was on the bench for that Champions League game and came on against Maribor. So they have quite a lot of youngsters, and they've won this now 2 years in a row, Chelsea. It's just whether or not you can put them in such a pressurised situation. He was saying that it's very difficult to throw a 17-year-old striker in when you're Chelsea. It's maybe easier to do it when you're further down, maybe in mid-table with not so much pressure on you.
Fair enough. Anyway, they'll be hosting Palace, who have won 6 of their last 7 away games. So we'll see if that actually will be the title decider. If they do win it there, of course, Liverpool have to give them a guard honour in the next game. Other matches include Spurs against City, which, I mean, that's a big game, isn't it?
City have tended to thrash Spurs. Apart from a time when they were basically downing tools under Mancini and Spurs beating 3-1 2 years ago. But back in October, it was Aguero scoring 4 goals against a terrible Spurs defence, and last season at White Hart Lane, it was 5-1 and 6-0 at the Etihad.
15 goals for and only 2 conceded in the last 3 meetings with Spurs. So, yeah, impressive stuff. And not a huge... There's a bit of Europa League interest in that for Tottenham.
Well, yeah, they're level on points with Liverpool.
Goal difference isn't much either. 4 goals.
The enthusiasm... The
for the
chain here, yeah, for these games. How about then the top four battle, which had Liverpool won, might have looked interesting. Had Liverpool won away at Hull, might have looked interesting from the point of view of Man United's 7-point lead over them in fourth place. If Man United, though, who are at home to West Brom, remember West Brom winning this fixture last season, wasn't it, with Morgan Amalfitano and Berahino? If West Brom were to get a result there, and they're doing okay in the last couple of games, aren't they, West Brom? Might this one still be on? Might there be a chance for Liverpool to sneak back in? No. Okay. All right.
No. You think, feel like Rodgers is in a fair bit of trouble. Changing the formation five times against Aston Villa in the semi-final was the mark of a confused manager at that point. It's not quite clear what the plan is at Anfield.
It's a tricky one with Rodgers, because he spoke after the Hull game and everything he said made a lot of sense, which is rare for him, to be honest. You know, he was saying we've lost 50 goals, you know, in the form of Luis Suarez, and made the point that Sturridge has been injured all season. He admitted that they struggled to win certain big games, and he's not sure why, and it's something he needs to work on, all of which is fine. He also made the point that they're playing about par, you know, being in fifth, but you know, I don't really buy that so much, just on the grounds of the amount of money they've spent, and spent so badly in many cases. But I personally don't think he has a future at Liverpool, but I also think it would be slightly harsh for them to sack him, because I think he still has credit in the bank from last season, even if he was carried along by Suarez quite a lot.
Mm. This is his third season at the club, though.
Yeah.
And the sentiment seems to be more that it's a step backwards rather than...
I do find it interesting that a lot of Liverpool fans seem to have turned on him. You know, where before he was St. Brendan, who could do no wrong. And I don't know if these are the sort of genuine Liverpool fans who go to loads of games, or just the some of the ones who shout a lot on the internet.
What
because
does Greg
they want
Bukowski
to show.
Say?
I don't know. I haven't spoken to him about it.
We need to check up on Greg.
They did really exceed expectation last year. And yeah, as Barry was saying, when Rodgers was making the point that being fifth is around par for them. Yeah, they have the fifth highest wage bill. So in that sense, where they are makes sense. But, I mean, the defence has actually improved a lot this season. Yeah, I think they conceded, 50 goals at this stage last year. They've conceded 37 to date now. It's just the attack, as they said, lost 50 goals. Yeah, their four strikers have scored as many as Everton's back four. And you know, we've all seen the kind of difficulties of replacing a genuine world class player. Spurs had it with Bale. They've had it with Suarez. There was a time when he was sort of made out to be this, again, a tactical genius after the defeat to Basel and the formation change that came out of that, the run they went on, and now it's again sort of drifting, slipping away. I mean, you wonder why he's brought Balotelli back into the team, even though Sturridge has had some physical issues again.
And he actually had a little pop at, I think it was a pop at Balotelli after the game, because he was saying, you know, it's made the point that it's more difficult for Coutinho because he's having to hold on to the ball longer because he doesn't have players making these runs like he did last season. So, you know, I think he's made a rod for his own back in the manner in which he spouts an awful lot of gibberish, and I think when things are going well, players are probably happy enough to row in behind that and just, you know, put up with it. But when things aren't going so well, they just start to go, who is this clown, you know, what is he on about? So.
This is Brendan Rodgers we're talking about, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Be fair, that's the situation then. And yeah, there are alternatives out there. I feel we've wrung as much as we can out of this Premier League weekend. How about we have another little bit of music and then move on to weightier issues? Quick mention of a Dublin dilettante who a couple of shows ago indeed asked about the Bradford Fire revelations and why they hadn't made it onto the pod. As Dublin Dilettanti themselves suggest, perhaps Foot Weekly not the place for such discussions. But, I mean, certainly we've been following it, and I suspect many of you have as well, the extraordinary series of articles that Daniel Taylor's written after the book published.
A book called 56, The Story of the Bradford Fire, written by Martin Fletcher, who was at the game the day of the fire and sustained quite serious burns, and also lost several members of his family from three different generations. So it's a particularly personal and harrowing thing for him. He's devoted years of his life to researching what happened that day and the build-up to it. And I think everyone's pretty familiar with the story by now, but the latest, just that the guy who owned Bradford City at the time, Stafford Higginbotham, businesses that he was connected with were burnt down mysteriously on eight other occasions. And the tribunal held afterwards, presided over by Sir Oliver Popplewell, didn't find anything untoward. And this week, Daniel Taylor sat down with Sir Oliver Popplewell for an interview that was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable.
So I'd recommend to anyone to dig it out and read it and draw their own conclusions.
Indeed so. All right, Lawrence Gissel says, back to business, AC Jimbo. I think Hartlepool deserves a mention in the pod as they survived despite being 10 points adrift in January. That's good, isn't it?
And weirdly, they've survived under the stewardship of Ronnie Moore, at the expense of Tranmere, who Ronnie Moore used to manage, but got the bullet from.
Right.
And Tranmere now gone down into the conference.
Sean Dyche going down with Burnley, while the man that he replaced at Burnley is coming up with, almost certain to come up now with Bournemouth, Eddie Howe.
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, the club that Sean Dyche left to go to Burnley was Watford, who were also coming up.
Hey.
That's a coincidence?
Yeah. A lot of speculation as to whether they become the priority for the Pozzo family now,
right?
Rather than Udinese, because this, a colleague of mine pointed out to me the other day, in going up, they will get, what, 70, 75 million? And even the parachute payments, if they were to go back down, would be of a similar amount. So, what, 140 million or something, which is what Udinese make in 3 years, even with a lot of top sales. So, even though they've come out and said no, you know, Udinese is still a sort of priority, particularly with everything they're doing around the stadium. It's very hard to kind of not see a scenario whereby Watford, being the financial power of that triumvirate of clubs, if you like, becomes the focal point.
Right. Anyway, James, more of your Serie A stuff later on, but let's talk Bournemouth now. Bournemouth, the Cherries, or as Barry describes them, the new Chelsea.
That's harsh.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is it? Is it? We've actually got a Tame Guardian writer, Scott Anthony, who's been a Bournemouth fan through thick and thin, or at least so he claims, on the line now. Hey, Scott, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi. Tell me about the scenes there in Bournemouth post this extraordinary success. Not quite mathematically secure yet, but unless you lose 19-0 away at Charlton on the weekend, you're up.
Yeah, I mean, it's like waking up in a save game of Championship Manager, basically. There's that amazing line in Fever Pitch about there's not many Michael Thomas moments in football, let alone life, but there's even fewer Eddie Howe moments in life or football. So it's just... it's just extraordinary, really. You're going from a team that is famous for cult players like Jimmy Glass, for slightly uninteresting trivia about like James Hayter's hat-trick, and you was training on a public school pitch, a sort of public school that's basically famous in the modern era for really annoying Derek Jarman, to like, you know, just unbridled joy and kind of prospects of trips to Anfield, to Old Trafford, to White Hart Lane and all the rest. And it's absolutely extraordinary.
Derek Jarman reference tick. Excellent. How have they done it? I mean, you mentioned Eddie Howe, and everyone's drooling over the golden boy of English management at the moment. Is it him? Is it a superb backroom staff a la Southampton? Or has it been Russian millions? What's been the key, Scott?
Well, can I start? I think the Russian millions thing it kind of annoys me, so can I put that to bed first? I
mean, put it to bed, Scott.
I remember at the end of last season, and we just kind of missed out on the playoffs. And Lewis Graben had scored more goals at a higher level for Bournemouth than anyone sort of in history, which sounds ridiculous, but it's true. And he was sold because we couldn't afford to match Norwich's wages, and also they offered a lot of money. So I think the thing about the Russian money is it enabled to keep elements of the squad together, and it meant that the money that you got from selling Graben could be reinvested. And as it happened, you know, it went on Callum Wilson, and it's been an extraordinary success. But I think it's kind of completely misleading to say in any way they bought success. And I mean, to answer your question, it's a kind of alchemy of all sorts of things, isn't it? But I think Eddie Howe is kind of extraordinary, not just extraordinary manager, but extraordinary coach, and he's built a very sort of well-drilled first 11. It's essentially the same kind of League One team, and goals come from lots of areas, and they kind of go on these amazing runs. Actually, runs of defeats as well as victories, but you know, you kind of get these enormous sweeps of sort of 15, 16 game runs, and then some weird stuff, and then it kind of comes back. And you know, it's kind of alchemy of attacking. I mean, in a way, I'm interested in the sense that Howe has obviously watched Bournemouth, and when I sort of watch Bournemouth, in a sense, I see the best parts of the Red Mat Bournemouth team, the best parts of the O'Driscoll Bournemouth team, even the sort of Machin team, and it's kind of a grace tits of kind of attacking football in Bournemouth, which has always been, I think, a little bit associated with the club, and that's, you know, what he's kind of turned into its DNA, I think.
Brilliant. Well, you mentioned one or two names from the past there, and it's worth underlining, especially for anyone who may be listening abroad, what an extraordinarily checkered past they have had of late. 17 points deduction for them for financial problems at the start of the season 7 years ago, which almost led to dropping out of the Football League. But within, 6 years now, gaining promotion to the top flight. I mean, it makes Swansea look sluggish in terms of their rise.
Okay, in terms of numbers, Bournemouth as an area is relatively large, sort of 400,000 odd people, but you know, that kind of civic pride that you got sort of in Hull or in Swansea or in sort of, kind of, you know, people invest in infrastructure and build this kind of build at least the possibility of Premier League football. It's never really happened before. Bournemouth has kind of still a kind of town mentality, and in fact the town has, I think, an odd relationship with the football club, which goes back actually to the financial difficulties you mentioned. And so that, I think, makes it even more extraordinary then, since it is very much like a arts and crafts project in a sort of era of kind of mass building, you know. I think that's kind of worth stressing as well.
Can your arts and crafts project survive in the harsh and cruel world of the Premier League, do you think?
Well, there's two answers to that, and one is numbers, and that would suggest that sooner or later economic gravity will sort of suck them down. And the other answer, I think, is that, you know, well-drilled attacking football, in a sense, you saw with Reading at least the first season they went up, or with Swansea that it can be done. And I think, you know, perhaps beyond the first 11 there's a bit of a worry, in the sense that, you know, you've got your sort of reserve left back as Ian Hart. It's been a fantastic signing, actually kind of an extraordinary career actually in many ways, but perhaps not the reserve left back you're going to want in the Premier League, and is similar at centre back. We've got, you know, very, very kind of thin resources there. So there will be some need for investment. And in that sense, it will be interesting to see whether, that will happen. But, who knows? Let's see.
Very interesting, Scott. Well, listen, enjoy, anyway, the celebrations once it's finally mathematically confirmed for the Cherries. And many thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. And, I'm kind of primed for Charlton on Saturday.
Great tweet, actually, from Charlton. They say, so Bournemouth are discounting the possibility of losing 9-0.
At 19-0.
We'll see, ... Have you been to Dean Court? Or is it, I believe it's
Gold Sands Stadium.
The Gold Sands Stadium.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
All right, what did you think, Jacob?
It's a nice ground. It's very small. They're going to have to do a few things in terms of the media facilities, given the demand that there will be for the Premier League.
Bigger kitchens, you think?
Place for ostriches to bury their heads and so on. And,
well, cold sand, well, we're better.
Well, yeah, right by the beach, actually, so that should be absolutely fine for all the people who want to do that.
Yep.
But obviously, when you go to a championship game, there's not as many journalists there, but if you go to Manchester United, when they go away, it's just absolutely packed, and the demand is so much bigger. But there was a story that they were going to think about extending the ground to 15,000, but they've also said that they wouldn't absolutely do that based on the fact that they could easily go down, and you have to think about where you're going to be in 2 years' time or a year's time, rather than just going out and splashing cash based
really?
On...
That's disappointing.
Based on what's happening right now.
I'd say they should splash that cash.
$25,000.
I'm not so sure they will go down, you know. Really? Eddie Howe's record is remarkable. He's 37 years old. He's already overseen 330 matches as a manager.
Wow.
And his win percentage is just under 50.
Joined Bournemouth at the age of 10.
Yeah,
was managing them by, I think, 12 or so.
Stuart James spent a day with him earlier this year. And, he described him as affable, humble and erudite with a fierce determination to succeed.
Right.
He seems to be incredibly meticulous. You know, he writes up notes on every single training session he's ever done and keeps them in a big black ledger. And he seems to have a pretty good backroom staff and... Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it gets on. I wish him well.
Amazing. Amazing. Anyway, exciting though that is, you've got a much better story from Italy, haven't you? James Horncastle.
Another Cinderella story.
Another, but even more Cinderella.
Yeah, because Carpi...
Carpi are up in Serie A. Have that, Lotito, Lazio president.
Yeah, that was the banner in the stands the other night was in your face, Lotito, because... Claudio Lotito is the Lazio owner, but he is a big power broker in the Italian Football Federation. He got the current president elected. Some think he has too much power, and he was caught on a wiretap a few months ago, basically saying that if teams like Carpi and Frosinone were to get promoted, it would be a disaster, because Serie A already has waning appeal, and how many people are going to be around the world wanting to tune in to watch Carpi against Chievo, Carpi against Sassuolo. Mm. So ever since then, there's been a sort of seeking vengeance of Carpi. And
how small is Carpi, James?
Well, the population is only 70,000 people. If you go back 15 years ago, they were in the amateur leagues. They'd folded, they'd gone completely bust, and they had to start again at the bottom of the football pyramid. And so... they've gone on this incredible rise of four promotions in 6 years, which has never happened before in the history of the Italian game. And they've done so, you know, with a wage bill which is €2.5 million. And to put that into perspective, that's what Gianpaolo Pazzini, so someone who warms up the bench for Milan, earns a year. I think their highest paid player is on $100,000 a year as well. So again, they've done it on a shoestring, really, through. Yeah, sort of the power of ideas rather than the power of money. And their coach, Fabrizio Castori, I think this is his ninth promotion, but it's his first promotion, and of course it's Carpi's first time in Serie A. So, very much a fairy tale.
They've made it up despite the views of the likes of Lotito. Mm. So there's a certain amount of carping going on, I should think, right now. Should I just stress, this is not in any way Capri. This is a different place to... Capri, the island just off Naples, and this is Carpi, which is in the province of Modena, up in Emilia-Romagna. Yeah.
It's a great sort of sporting region, if you think Ferrari is based around there as well. Parma went down last night after their defeat to Lazio, and as we're talking about Bournemouth needing to sort of improve their stadium.
Right.
There's a very high probability that Carpi will have to find another stadium to use, which could be the Ennio Tardini, because their ground is tiny. So
they might borrow Parma's stadium.
Yes,
all right.
It's one of the options I think they're possibly exploring.
Yeah, poor old Parma, mathematically confirmed as down in a big midweek round of action. Should quickly mention on the subject of the Championship. So Watford are up, and this weekend will decide who gets top spot, because it's the final weekend of the Championship, isn't it?
This is the final weekend, and Watford are at home to Sheffield Wednesday. Bournemouth at Charlton, and Watford are top by a point, so Bournemouth are reliant on Sheffield Wednesday doing them a favour. Sheffield Wednesday actually halted Bournemouth's progress, and Sheffield Wednesday, the reason that Bournemouth aren't top, because they drew 2-2 at Bournemouth 2 weeks ago in the 95th minute penalty. But also at the bottom, you've got the relegation situation wrapped up now with Millwall and Wigan, which was a FA Cup semi-final 2 years ago. They're both down, drawing Blackpool in League One. I think Carl Oyston's been, or the owner of Blackpool's been winding up Blackpool fans again this week with the statue, hasn't he?
Yeah, he removed a statue of Stan Mortensen on Tuesday, I think, from the concourse outside Bloomfield Road because fans were planning on having a protest there on Saturday. So the statue which was partly funded by Blackpool fans, has mysteriously disappeared.
Wow.
To be replaced by one of Michael Jackson. Right. So Rotherham stay up despite being deducted 3 points for a fielding an ineligible player, a lone player against Brighton a few weeks ago. They got deducted 3 points, but they beat Reading 2-1 on Tuesday night to stay up. And Steve Evans was very excited. He's going to celebrate with 12 bottles of pink champagne or something and could be wearing a sombrero and beach clothes against Leeds. I think they're playing on Saturday.
It's quite a picture.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, looking forward
to it. So basically, the automatic promotion places are all but sorted out, barring something quite extraordinary with Bournemouth at Charlton. And the relegation spots are all done. So all that's left to be decided is the playoff positions.
Yeah, well, Middlesbrough and Norwich are sure of their places.
Right.
They were the ones who were challenging for the automatic place as well, but they just fallen short. So Ipswich are fifth on 78, Derby 77, and then you've got Brentford and Wolves on 75 each. And Brentford are at home to Wigan, and already relegated Wigan. The same for Wolves. They play Millwall at home, so you would expect them to win. And Ipswich are away at Blackburn. They probably have the hardest game. Blackburn with Rudy Justed up front, and fairly strong at Ewood Park, and not certain of finishing in ninth place. They've had a good season, so that will be difficult for Ipswich, but they've got a lot of firepower up front, and with the top scorer in the Championship, Daryl Murphy, and Freddie Sears, who came in January from Colchester, scored his ninth goal since then in the win over Forest last week, the winner, late winner. So yeah, I think Ipswich will probably be fine. So it's really Derby who are the ones who, I think that they've been affected possibly by the talk of Steve McLaren going to Newcastle. I think that it's been a bit of an issue. Not absolutely certain of that happening, but there's been a lot of talk about that happening. And whether you would look at Derby and think they should already be in the Premier League. They should have won the playoff final last season. They should have beaten QPR. They end up losing that in the last minute. They're hard to trust. They've won two of their last 12, and a lot of people had them down as the champions at the start of the season, and they've not done it. They're sixth, and they should get the point they need against Reading, but they might not.
Wow. Jacob, I have to say,
I've just been writing about the champions.
Oh, right, because you did that without any notes, or indeed breathing, actually. So phenomenal. Anyway, it's the last weekend of the championship.
Yeah, and then it goes into the playoffs.
And then, of course, there's the playoffs. Yeah. Who gets into the... No, it's okay. right, so the only other thing we should really talk about today is Europe, because I think probably haven't been talking about it too much in the last couple of shows, but also...
What are you suggesting?
Just that the attention's been elsewhere. Then fascinating things about the Women's Super League, that was really good. And all sorts of other things. Chelmsford, enjoyed all of that.
Yep.
But there's been some important things going on around Europe. For example, Bayern Munich, who last weekend wrapped up the German title again for the third season in a row, then marched into their semi-final in the DFB Pokal, the German Cup, with their old rivals Borussia Dortmund on Tuesday night. There was a lot of excitement about this because it was the final Der Klassiker that Jurgen Klopp would be managing Dortmund in, at least for the near future. And when Bayern took the lead through Robert Lewandowski, former Dortmund player, it looked like it was going to, you know, the treble dream was going to continue. They took off Thiago Alcantara, who'd been looking pretty special. They took him off. He got a bit of a knock on the knee, and they brought on Robin. And bizarrely, at this point, everything just stopped for them. Dortmund came back into the game. Robin then got injured, prompting questions about whether getting all the medical team fired might not have been the best idea, or they resigned. But anyway, he then goes off injured. And then it goes to Dortmund equalise, it was a scrappy goal, and it goes to penalties, and Barry, just amazing set of penalties.
Well, yeah, Germans obviously are renowned for their penalty-taking savvy, and it was conspicuously absent from this shootout.
Well, Dortmund won this shootout despite only scoring two of their penalties, because basically Bayern got all four of theirs wrong. The first two players slipped over, then there was a save, and then finally it was Manuel Neuer, who fancies himself with his feet, went up and hit the crossbar. Yeah. It was hilarious.
It was that great scene of Klopp running onto the pitch past Pep. It's good to see possibly Klopp go out on a high rather than go out on a whimper. Sort of, you know,
is there any way that Dortmund could sign Steven Gerrard in time for that final?
That'd be nice.
They should have been playing for Bayern with the slips, I think.
Well, yeah. Who are they going to play in the finals, James?
I think they're playing Wolfsburg.
Are they? Because they beat Arminia Bielefeld,
yeah,
did they?
The town that doesn't exist.
The town that doesn't exist.
It's a disastrous night for Bayern, though, because Robben's out for the season.
Yeah.
So, the Champions League semi-final.
Broke his jaw. Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah. Yesterday.
Well, I think he broke his nose, jaw, and got knocked out, basically.
After the game?
So, no, when he had the clash with the goalkeeper at the end, and he was wandering around very dazed and confused.
Wow.
But he said he tweeted.
I was a bit dazed because I was actually doing this game, but I just got back from Malaysia and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning, Malaysian time.
Yeah.
Luckily, I woke up for the penalty shootout. But before that, you know that thing where you're kind of like drifting in and out of consciousness and you say something weird and you wake up and think, God, what did I just say? Raphael Honigstein was kind of looking over and quite concerned. But yeah, everything went well. So what else did I miss? Lewandowski broke his jaw.
So he said he hopes to play because they're playing Barcelona next week.
Yeah.
So he hopes he'll be back.
Right.
Not to have Robben and Lewandowski potentially for that game would be disastrous.
Certainly. Wow. All right. Milan, tell me about the problems there. They've been locked up basically until they learn their lesson.
Yes, after the defeat to Udinese on Sunday, quite the fallout from it. Inzaghi, betrayed by his players, turning on them, saying that they were unworthy of the shirt. He then gets back on the team bus. And according to the papers, this is denied by the club, some of the players actually turn to him and says, well, we don't think you're up to the job either. They then play Genoa last night, lost to them at San Siro for the first time in 57 years, completely outplayed. There was an incredible choreography in the Milan Curva Sud before the game. It wasn't a banner. It was the ultras actually forming a human chain to say, basta, enough.
And of course, did they do that with a chain? Or were they wearing shirts?
No, they all linked arms.
Oh, I see.
And did it themselves. So, To spell basta, and the rest of the stand was empty.
So I see.
All you saw was the letter.
Basta.
Put an end to
this mess. R&D didn't turn up then.
But meanwhile, whilst this is going on, Bitesbol, this Thai financier broker, is meeting with Silvio Berlusconi to watch the game at his residence and to conclude the takeover of Milan.
If you turned up at Berlusconi's residence and ended up watching a football match, wouldn't you be hugely disappointed?
Yes. Yeah. They were speculating whether there was any... they called it Binga Binga rather than Bunga Bunga going on.
Because his name's Bitesbol.
Yes.
Right. So he's very optimistic that he's bought 51% for €500 million. Is that right?
Yes. Right. The fine details yet to emerge because Bitesbol is a wealthy individual from a wealthy family, but he doesn't seem to have all of that money himself. Mm. So who's behind him? There's talk of... an Abu Dhabi bank, which is run by the brother of Sheikh Mansour. There's talk of also a Chinese bank backed by the Communist Party, which many Italians are thinking is very ironic, given Berlusconi is very anti-communist. Mm. And also Doyen Sports, the fund, which is involved in many sort of third-party ownerships and has subsidised clubs like Atletico Madrid in the recent past, maybe coming in and supplying some of the players. But Bitesbol is apparently going to hold a press conference today reveal a little bit more. But it's quite incredible, really, when you think that Inter, a 65% in stake in them 18 months ago, went for something like €250 million.
Mm.
And Milan, 50% stake, is going for €500 million, which values the club at €1 billion. So even though the club has really fallen on hard times and hasn't been performing competitively, doesn't have a stadium to its name, it's just made a huge loss of €91 million, it still has great value because of the titles they've won, because of the brand that they have. So, but we have to see whether that all comes out to be true.
Right, okay. But in the meantime, they have to travel down to Naples, where they used to battle for titles with Napoli. But meantime, they're in 10th place. No chance, really, of European football for them. Napoli are only 2 points behind Roma, who've slipped to third in the race for Champions League places. That's going to be a really interesting game, and it's going to be on Sunday night. Mm. Yeah, after they finish the Vanarama playoffs.
Future as well.
Benitez's future, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that on Sunday night.
We will.
Yeah. That's probably more than enough from today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks then to Barry, James and Jacob.
Thank you.
Thank you, and producer Ben, and everyone who posted and tweeted in. How was the work?
strongest player.
Oh, now you ask, Barry. Now when I'm just shuffling my papers and looking busy. It was good. It was hot. It was humid. It was sweaty. I have to say, they ramped up the difficulty level quite considerably. Yeah, I think they felt that some of the big guys have been making it look a little bit too easy. So they did things to it. I mean, they just made things heavier and tougher. And there was some ligaments popping off the bone. There was a little bit of that. But there was also quite a dramatic finale. Very dramatic finale. I warmly recommend. American-based listeners will be able to enjoy this come summer on CBS. But the rest of us will have to wait until far away Christmas to discover who it is who walks away with the title of the strongest man in the world. Shocks galore in store.
Did you attempt
Christmas.
Any of the events?
Crikey, no. There's a time and a place for tomfoolery, and a very large Atlas stone is not one of them. Anyway, and on that sensible note, that's where we come to the end of today's show. Back on Monday. Have a super weekend. Bye-bye for now.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.